Welcome, listeners.
It's the black people of America. The real
to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all that getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, home base, and listen to the live stream there. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and listen to the live stream at that location. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And after you download it in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program and you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live. You can even stream it into your car. It's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook and Time for Awakening Media home base has been launched. In that address bar in your search engine, just type in timeforawakening.com. That's timeforawakening.com. It'll take you straight to Time for Awakening Media. There you'll see more interesting content and blogs, podcasts, and programs that you can download, listen at later times, even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites and put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforawakening.com will take you straight to Time for Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have two special guests join us on Time for Awakening. Filmmaker Rel Daldell will be here with us in conversation to talk about his new documentary film, Where's Daddy? It deals with interesting perspectives on the child support system and the special effects and consequences it has on African-American families. Brother Rel Daldell will be with us to talk about his new documentary film, Where's Daddy? The second portion of our program, we'll have activist organizer Oba Olainka will be with us to talk about the 13th annual African Independence Day celebration here in Philadelphia at Malcolm X Park at 52nd and Pine Street on August 5th. And we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Not a Wu-Tang. All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at Time for an Awakening at gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our special guest this evening in the conversation, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir. What's up? How you doing, Brother Allen?
How are you, sir?
Good, good, good. I think we're engaged for another really dynamic topic and discussion that relates to just our social and political and economic condition. The topic that Brother Del brings up, I'm a product of two generations where that system had an impact on that. So I kind of understand it. So it'll be interesting to see and hear how he's put his documentary to tell our story.
Yeah, it should be very interesting, both of our guests. And they're talking about things that affect our community from two different perspectives. Our first guest tonight, Brother Rel Dowdell, is homegrown Philly native, screenwriter and film director and film producer, born and raised in Philadelphia, has a bachelor's degree in English with magna cum laude from Fisk University, a master's degree in filmmaking and screenwriting with the highest distinction from Boston University. His first film in 2005, Train Ride, won the best feature at the African Theater of Harlem Film Festival in 2005, and it was the last performance by actress Esther Rolle in the movie Train Ride with the Brother Rel Dowdell. His next feature, Changing the Game, about a inner city youth that went to Wall Street and was able to affect change towards the community. Changing the Game came out in 2012. Rel will correct us when he comes on, and won awards. One of the top three African-American films of 2012. His new project, new documentary film called Where's Daddy? That's the topic for discussion tonight with filmmaker Rel Dowdell. Brother Rel, how are you, sir?
How you doing, Elliot? How you doing, Richard?
I'm doing fine. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, good to be on here. Great show.
I'm glad to have you with us. Brother Rell, listen, before we get started this evening, because I read a brief bio of some of your work, and you're now currently English professor at the Philadelphia College of Community College here in Philadelphia.
Right.
Talk about your before we talk about Where's Daddy, because that's a departure for you, so to speak, because even though it's films, it's a documentary film, it's not a feature film.
Right.
Talk about what made you kind of shift gears and do this documentary.
That's a good question, because, you know, I've never, when I, you know, when I was in school, I never thought about doing documentaries. I admire them, but you really don't see many, for whatever reason, I don't know what the reason really is. There's not really a lot of African-American filmmakers that do documentaries. Like, it's very rare you'll see an African-American documentary done, even though we have a plethora of stories to tell. So all my films that I've done so far, Train Ride and Changing the Game and now Where's Daddy, every film of mine has a theme of African-American men who have to, as you stated earlier so well, endure some kind of hardship and then evoke change. So I felt like doing this film, Where's Daddy, it really was a vision to me one night. I was watching, ironically enough, I was watching that crazy show, Maury Povich, and I was like, how come every show this Maury Povich does, he kind of uses black men almost as a stepping stool to show them running from being a responsible parent? It's like that you are not the daddy type of thing. It gives him great ratings, but it makes the black man look very irresponsible, and it characterizes his wanting to be a responsible parent. So I said, well, what if I do a documentary just showing how black men are affected by the child support situation? Black men who want to be good parents or responsible parents, who have hardships, whether financially, socially, just enduring hardships that make them not capable of being a good parent. And therefore, unfortunately for many black men, they have to endure incarceration, which really compounds the situation when that happens, as I'm sure you and Richard have known, you know, can read about and attest to from others you've spoken to.
Rell, your work in this film, and you mentioned that your first comment about not too many of our people do documentary films. And you're right, because I would like to see some of these stories being told, not in the fashion of, and I don't want to criticize Birth of a Nation. I think it was a good picture in its own right. But stories like that, I think, need to be told in a documentary fashion, because you would kind of get more of a truth and a real feel for the people talked about. You have Spike Lee that have done several documentaries, and I thought very well done. Four Little Girls, the two that he did on Katrina, the one that he did on Jim Brown. I thought those documentaries were very well done. I can't wait to see your documentary, because knowing you and knowing your slant and your understanding of our community, being that you grew up right here in Philadelphia, I would love to see, and I see some of the people that's in the documentary, two of them I know personally. So I think it would be very interesting, and I can't wait to see it. But talk about...
You know, it's funny you say that. I'm going to tell you,
go ahead.
As you make your point, the reason why I think a lot of black men or blacks in general don't make documentaries is because they're not, quote-unquote, you know, the sexy Hollywood project, right? So you're not going to get the big, like the movie that came out this past weekend that made $30 million, Girls Trip, right? You're not going to get that big Hollywood cachet off of doing the documentary. If you can find any audience at all, for instance, Four Little Girls was made for about $4 or $5 million. It had a really, really good budget for a documentary. But when it came out in theaters, it only made $100,000. See what I mean?
Okay.
So the trade-off is a documentary can be a very powerful, as you say, a vessel for change. But as far as getting people to embrace the documentary, people don't rush out to the theater to go see documentaries. They just don't, unless it's like Michael Moore, right? Michael Moore does something, and then Michael Moore is able to use his name to make a film like Fahrenheit or other ones that he's made and make a killing in the theaters, but it's very, one out of maybe every 100 or so documentaries can come out to the theater range and perform. So I think that's maybe the reason why a lot of people say, you know what, I may have a great document idea, but it may be better for me to do features. Now, one came out recently last year called The 13th that performed well. That came out online.
Now, how about I'm Not Your Negro?
That came out in theaters. That did well, and that got an Oscar nomination. But I think it should have been seen by even more people that even saw it. I think it did relatively well in the theaters. But and that's about James Baldwin, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an iconic figure. Even that film could have done much, much better. I saw it twice in the theaters, actually. And both times when I saw it, the theater was maybe half full. I went with one time in Cherry Hill. I went again to another place at the Ritz. I saw it twice to support the film because it's by black filmmaker Raoul Peck. But it, you know, both times I saw it, it was probably maybe a quarter full. But people loved it.
But I think it's also, I'd like to add to get your feedback on, it's the question about the African-American story being told from a realistic perspective in that documentary format, that even as the audience, the African-American audience, we're not really, really ready to hear our story as it's told. Because and I'm only saying that from the perspective of how much are we celebrating even our own history. And from one generation to the next. And then on the other side, white audiences aren't actually opening when you use Michael Moore or as a you know, that audience is more open to support those ideals. But when you get down to the African-American story, they're not as well ready to come to the theater to actually watch that or to view that or to be confronted by that because of possible implications.
That's right. And the Oscar that won last year, like, I mean, I agree with Ellie. Like, I Am Not Your Negro, to me, was stellar. But the Oscar that won last year for Best Documentary was the O.J. documentary that was on ESPN.
Right.
That won it, you know. So when it came down to really giving the Best Documentary Award out, I Am Not Your Negro and the 13th were overlooked for the O.J. Documentary.
Brother Rel, let's get into Where's Daddy? I know that usually when people do documentaries that I've seen, they kind of travel all over and talk to various people in different parts of the country. But in conversations with you off the air, you said that you intended to do that when you put this documentary together. But you found that you had a cross-section of people right here in this tri-state area of Philadelphia, where you put together the documentary basically here.
Right.
Talk about the men, the cross-section of men that were involved. Because usually when people talk about child support, and it's through media. Media is a drug, and it affects all of us in different ways. And usually when they talk about child support, immediately people's mind go to the foolishness that you just talked about earlier, a Maury show with young people acting a fool on television, talking about, I don't want that child, I don't this and that. But child support, it comes from a cross-section of people, whether it's a young person that made a mistake and had a child early, whether it was a married couple that was married for a while and couldn't make it, or whether it was a boyfriend, girlfriend. It comes from all different stratas, but it seems as though system-wide that whatever happens, the system always manages to twist things where it can doubly or triply affect the African-American community. Talk about it from your perspective of getting a cross-section of men to talk about their experiences dealing with child support.
Good question. Like, when I first thought about it, I had a producer, Melody, and another gentleman, Maurice. We all sat down. I was like, I got to really get a good variety of people here. And I was working with a very, very limited budget. So I said, well, if I do have to travel, it's got to be somewhere where I could drive to, you know, hopefully not too far. So we sat down, and after a while, we said, you know what? Between the three of us, we can count with a good more than a dozen people that are in the Philadelphia area alone that will be more than happy to tell their stories. It's almost like for the black man in the film, from the one who makes the least amount of money to the high-profile athlete like Fred Barnett, who played for the Eagles and made the Pro Bowl in the 80s, everybody seemed to have, like, catharsis, meaning, like, for the black men involved, you could see, like, talking about this on camera with another black man who was like-minded and conscientious. That's why I made sure that when I sat down with these brothers, I didn't come off pretentious and haughty. I was like, let's sit down man to man and let me know what you feel about this issue. And for them, it was like catharsis. And that's why, you know, you see one brother who got so emotional that he broke down. You see someone like, you know, Fred Barnett, who was sitting in front of the Lincoln Stadium talking about his issues. And everybody's issue is different. But I covered all socioeconomic backgrounds. One subject is 70 years old, and he's dealing with it, Dr. Ralph Smith. So, like you said, it doesn't just affect one part of the black community. It affects the young person who may have just made a judgment in hindsight that may have been rash, or it could have been someone who's even, you know, potentially a senior citizen who's dealing with this issue with a relationship that didn't work out. It could have been went wrong somewhere. But one thing I can say, Elliot, Richard, is that when you look at the black men that deal with this issue, you can see the stress in their face. You can see the extra lines in their brow. That this situation between the relationship being a failure or not being able to be there for your child or children as much as they would want to, you can see, like, the miles on the car, they start to go up and go up and go up. And I think for these brothers in this film, to talk about the issue released a great deal of stress that helps them. If that makes sense, what I'm saying.
Definitely. Definitely for me, as far as just being able to know that, because we're so isolated in this here, as you bring out, you know, you don't want to tell about it, but at the same time, you're being confronted with it all the time because of the double nature of, are you quote unquote manning up as a father, but at the same time, do you have all you need in order to do what you need to do as a man and a father? So I can probably relate to that point.
And it seems to me that this issue is something that black men and black women really need to talk about. Like, I hope this film, I can only pray that when the film is released, in however way it's released, that it causes some dialogue, because it seems to me that there's a bridge here, there's a gap between the black man and black woman as far as really talking about this issue to really try to make some changes, because for the black man that really does not have the financial capacity to provide for the child, if he doesn't have it, or if he's unable to provide for whatever reason physically, is it the right thing to do to punish this man by putting him in jail for trying? If he's completely, you know, doesn't want to do anything for whatever reasons, well, that's a whole different story.
Mm-hmm.
But the black man who really is like, you know what, I really do want to provide. I'm trying. What can be done to help me help the situation? And to just throw him in jail with a murderer and his cellmate is a rapist or a murderer, to me that just seems like that's not the best possible solution to this problem. I think that just compounds the problem, in my opinion.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned that the solution to this problem is going to come from our people or black couples, because you can see that the system just wants to throw these black men in jail. They don't care. They don't want to hear no explanation. But, you know, it has to be hashed out. It has to be talked about. You know, I saw the trailer of the documentary. The one brother talked about, he walks across the Ben Franklin Bridge just to see his children because he can't afford the car for to get over here, so he has to walk. The one brother said that he, $13 a week that he provides to try to provide meals, and I think that's the brother that broke down.
Yes.
You know, this is no Maury type of thing where, you know, this man makes millions of dollars at the expense of some of our people that ignorantly go on in and make a fool of themselves. This is serious. The overwhelming majority of these cases is similar to what you document in the film. Now, you sent me an article, and it's interesting because you said that the stress that it puts on our people is tremendous. I want to share this article with the listening audience, and then I want you to take it from there, Brother Rel. You sent me this article here. It's an AP report, and it's about a gentleman that we knew of because it made national news. It says, Walter Scott and child support, did the threat of jail contribute to his death? The fear of going to jail for not paying child support set off a chain of events that ended up with an unarmed black man being fatally shot in the back by a white police officer in South Carolina, according to the family of Walter Scott. Scott's death on Saturday was captured on video and fueled national outrage as an example of another unjustified killing of a black man at the hands of police. The killing also highlighted what advocates say is an injustice in the child support enforcement system, which can punish non-custodial parents who don't pay child support with jail time and disproportionately affects African-American men. Scott was stopped for a broken taillight when his encounter with Officer Michael Slager, who was charged with murder, turned deadly in North Charleston, South Carolina. Scott was fleeing from Slager when he was shot 8 times in his back. Black men live in constant fear, period. And I think that fear that Scott had was on a different level. There needs to be more uncovering of how child support system works and whether it helps families who are really poor. For families that make less than $10,000 a year, is helping those children be in a better place when they know their parents are under constant stress of being locked up. Non-custodial parents have a child support agreement that wasn't hashed out by private attorneys. In that case, they can be held in contempt of court and a bench warrant issued for their arrest when they don't pay after a certain amount of time. In such a case as Walter Scott, the slain South Carolina man had been arrested 10 times for failing to pay child support, according to the Charleston Courier-Post. So we see that this whole scenario that led to Walter Scott being shot centered around child support and being constantly locked up. Talk about that from your perspective, Brother Rel, because you sent me that article.
I'm glad you read that. And hearing it again is heart-wrenching. And also, before I talk about that, I'm glad you also mentioned the trailer, because for those that are in your listening audience, you can see the trailer for Where's Daddy on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and put in Where's Daddy trailer, and it comes right up, and you can see all the things that Brother Elliot mentioned. The more people they see that trailer, the better, because whoever watches that will pass it on. I think Walter Scott, even though his name is Walter Scott, he represents a great deal of black men across this country who are dealing with that issue, and he got the worst end of the situation by losing his life, and I just think that the only way, like you said earlier, that the Walter Scott situation, or the other one I sent you about Michael Robinson, who died in jail because he couldn't get an insulin shot, and other black men who die because of the child support system, it's got to be some powerful people to help make change. And like you said, the change is going to start with dialogue between black men and black women. Walter Scott there's people out here who have more than 10 support orders than he has. Some of them have 20, some have 30, on their record, but they don't know what to do. That, I guess the main thing that, and I want to ask you and Richard the same thing, is like with this dialogue, is like, what really can be done to help brothers in that situation? Like what really can black men do for each other to help them deal with these types of things? Because, one thing about black men also, we have to help each other is get through these things as well. And I think that the police and everyone are involved in Walter Scott's tragedy. But before this tragedy happened, there was a disconnect somewhere where Walter Scott got on this trajectory downward that led to this unfortunate demise. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
If I may, Elliot.
Go ahead, Richard.
And I appreciate you raising that point, because as I was looking over things to, just to engage in this conversation, like I said, I come I'm a child of public assistance. So my father, who wasn't around, and I'm saying this for a particular point, by the time I was in my 40s, he got notice from the child support system. Now, my mother had never wanted to place him under the system, but the way the law is written, even if the woman doesn't place you under, you're still obligated by the state to pay for child support. Also my brother, who they didn't have. My father was able, because of time, to be able to they worked that out, because my mother consistently refused to place them under, and they needed that, the law set for, and then age. But my brother had to serve time for child support while he was taking care of his children. But when I looked at the law, to your question, it seems that for Black men particularly, that we have to realize that this is a political issue, and a political issue that was created to get money, just like people being pulled over and given tickets or for unnecessary things, where we've heard in these counties, this was a way that they generated income. Well, the child support system, as I've seen it, was a way that the state was to generate income. And then the federal came in order to, to compensate the state for the public assistance money that it was providing the state. So, we as Black men have to recognize that this is a political issue that we have to come to the table with a policy to turn back the way this system is operating, because it isn't operating in our best interest because of the things that you bring out in those personal experiences in your documentary.
And not only that, Richard, it's, the bottom line is the Black father is someone that people don't really give a lot of credit to at all in society. So I can tell you, I'm going to tell you and Brother Elliot right here firsthand, I know if I didn't have my father and mother active in my life, I can promise you that I would not be here today making films or being an educator or even wanting to get an advanced degree or going to Masterman or Central. I needed all the support that I could get growing up, because I know that it doesn't take but one small turn to end up somewhere else, as you and I and all of us can attest to. So just by having, like you said, your father had issues and your brother had issues, it doesn't take but one situation like that to really – dismantles the whole family structure, right? So once you see your father or your grandfather or someone else in your, as a Black man, have that kind of issue, it trickles down. It hurts the generations, not just the son, it also hurts the daughter. I mean, it's very, like you said, it's very systematic how it oftentimes the child support system completely dismantled the Black family.
You know, Brother Rell, you sent me some different statistics. And, I was unaware of this type of thing because, I've been fortunate that I haven't, been forced to be in the child support system. But this article that I just read, the portion that says non-custodial parents who have a support agreement that wasn't hashed out by private attorneys can be held in contempt of court. I mean, and then on the heels of that statement, I turned around and read some of those different child support laws that vary from state to state, but all of them basically have the same theme, that no matter who you are, and it disproportionately affect Black people in jail. When I read the cases of all the people in prison, all the Blacks that are in prison, over half of them are in there for child support. And if they're not in there for child support directly, it's a child support case in the background that's waiting for them. So, you know, that is an excellent thing that you raise, because these things have to be, the solutions to these problems have to come from us. You know,
me and I think the only way to do it is that they have to hear black men say it themselves. Like, you know, if I made a documentary and all I'm putting up there is a bunch of, you know, figures or things like that, that's your typical documentary. I say, you know what, I want to go right to the source. Like, I want to hear from the black men themselves. Like, what have you gone through? Tell me what led you to where you're at. And to see black men break down about it, it really lets you know, like we said earlier, it's devastating a lot of black men. I just think that it's going to take a lot of change, and I don't know if where the change is going to come from as far as getting more equality for the situation, but it's got to be something to be said. Like, Richard made a point that was very profound. He said that his mother did not want to put the father under the order so that he would have had to serve time. But unfortunately, in our community, that's not the case. A lot of times, that's the first option, because you mentioned earlier about the attorney. You said, well, but you know what? Unfortunately, a lot of black men can't afford attorneys for these situations.
Mm-hmm.
If they can't afford to pay child support, they can't afford to pay an attorney who makes $400 an hour, right? So the black man that goes into court for the hearing by himself without the attorney, he's looking across from him across the courtroom, and he sees a high-paid attorney for the other side. He's at a loss before he even gets a word out, because he doesn't know the law. He doesn't know how these things are going to work. He's just sitting there basically as a sitting duck for a sentence, if that makes sense, what I'm getting at.
That, I mean, that's the reason why it's a systemic. I mean, and that's why it's a part. It was intentionally designed. I think it is the opposite side, because when you look at our community, particularly the opposite side of the public assistance system, you know, that supposedly support women, which at that point was that you couldn't even have a man in the house if you got public assistance, meaning that even if you didn't have that, you wanted, the father wanted to be with his family, but because of the economics of and job, you know, the job opportunities, if you couldn't do that, you had to go away, then, and the woman, the mother, collects the public assistance. That was set up so that to make sure that he or no other man would be in the house to provide that other male or man support, as you said, that is necessary. So it's a part of a broader system. But one thing I did see in the clips that raised the question for me, and I'd like to see your response to it. It did also bring out about these men, in spite of the systemic and the public assistance, what it meant to be a father. I think that, you know, that was brought out also, and I would like you to kind of develop, how did that impact you, what fatherhood meant to these black men?
Yeah, that's why I think that was the real impetus of the film to begin with, was even though, and you know, that's the history really of the black man in this country. Even though the black male has really had to overcome some things that are just, that would put others in the grave, a lot of black men still find a way to survive and thrive and make a name for themselves. And I just wanted to show that even though, you know, all these brothers have really dealt with the worst of circumstances with the child support issue, they still want to be good parents and loving parents, and they still want to be active, and they don't want to be someone that's forgotten about in their children's lives. And I think that's what's important. And like Brother Elliot said earlier, that's why shows like the Maury Povich show and other shows that really show black men running at all costs to not be a father, or they're thanking God that they're not the parent of the child, or they want to make somehow turn the table and say, well, I was tricked into this, or I was lured into this somehow. I didn't know that I was going to be a parent. I think that whole image needs to be changed, because the Maury Povich show was seen all over the world. People watch that show in China. Mm-hmm. They might watch that show in the Caribbean. They may watch that show in Africa. If that show is really seen as much as we all know it is, imagine what the view of the black man is in that country if they've never been a black man before.
Exactly. Exactly. We got a call on hold. Let's go to the call. 267 area code. 267.
Hey, good evening, Elliot. Good evening, Richard. And I want to say good evening to your guests.
How are you, sir?
Hey, how you doing?
All right. All right, man. Hey, look, I got to say to your guests, that's good that you're going right to the brothers that went through that, because let me tell you something. It's nothing but criminal activity in the justice system, and I'm speaking from my experience. My ex-wife, who was a registered nurse, made about $50 an hour. We had one child between us, and when we had separated, you know, the child support system made me pay $2,200 a month. And I'm saying, how is this? You know what I mean? How is this? But they actually wanted to break me, to actually, you know, to get me in arrears where I would have to pay them all their life. But, you know, I thank the creator that I just went on ahead, let that be deducted out my check. My son at that time was about 16 years old. And they used bitter black women against brothers. And even if that sister's even at fault, they still use the bitterness of some of these sisters to kill us. And that way they're using our children as a weapon, yes, against us, man. And you have to be in the right mind frame to see through the game, make sure that you're the parent that you should be, and still love your children through all that garbage. I'm gonna have to go there. And Richard, you were blessed to have that lady in your life. But I'm telling you, I've seen it just sitting there, seeing case after case.
I agree.
How they use the women's bitterness against the man.
And that, brother, did you have an attorney when you went to court? I mean,
yes, I did. I fired one and got another one, and he got it down to 1,600. But they threw in some other stuff, and she was claiming that the economy was bad and she couldn't get a job, and they didn't even make her bring any pay stubs. My lawyer recommended she pay, and she wouldn't bring any. And they continued to take it out of my check. I just think, you know, like I said, I've seen the injustice that they do, man. So, you know, all those brothers that's out there, like, not paying child support, whatever, they can't afford it. And plus, they know for a fact these brothers can't afford it. It's an unjust, illegal system. I know plenty of good men that love their children, that try to be in their children's lives, but it's the bitterness of the woman that just keeps, and like I said, these people have studied us so much. They know how to play us against one another, and they also, through your documentary, they now know how to use our children as a weapon against us, causing further division. So I just wanted to call in and speak from my experience, because that's what I normally always do anyway. I just talk about what I've been through, and you're absolutely correct with your video and everything else, man. It's killing these brothers out here.
I hope when we get this released, brother, you'll see it, and you can go look at the trailer online and tell people, because I'm really trying to get this out before the end of the year. And I hope that it brothers like yourself are just like the ones in the movie, brothers who really were trying to do the right thing, and whether it was bitterness or hardship or something, but the one thing I have seen among all the brothers in there, there was no sympathy for them anywhere. No one gave them a break when they really were asking for some assistance. They didn't get it. And by talking to these brothers face to face, not on Skype, I can just see the pain. I can look at these brothers and just see them, like, just rehashing it. It's almost like opening up a wound on their arm, like, by talking about it. You know what I mean? It was like just talking about what happened to them made them, like, it's like tearing off a scab.
Right. Now, I'm going to tell you, some of it's substance abuse. You know what I mean? Now, you see, now since the substance abuse has went into another society, you know, they want to treat it like it's this, or, you know, oh, woe is me. We got to do something about this. Let's get them help. But when it was our people being directly with the man, they threw everything in the book, including child support, against them, knowing what we're up against. I'm watching a series right now that's showing you about the crack cocaine epidemic and how the CIA was right behind it. I mean, this thing is so criminal. They use everything against us.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not on our, if we're not really on our game, I mean, and that got to include the sisters. Now, I know they were socially engineered in the early 90s with all these black feminist shows, Oprah, and all this mess was coming out, and the black man was the enemy. But they didn't really see the real enemy behind the scenes creating through discrimination, through hardships, through a lot of different things. So, separate, and they used the bit. I've seen this right in my own. They used the bitterness of that female to keep us in check, man. I'm telling you. So I just wanted to call in and give my, you know, my experience with child support. $2,200 a month for one child, and this woman was a registered nurse. They let me see right through them, but I would not let that deter my love for my child, and that would not be, you know, resort to violence or anything like that. Even though I carried some anger toward that person for a long time, I'm glad that I could, like, get it together, and now we're on speaking terms years later. But I'm telling you, man, it's really rough out there on black men. We have no sympathy whatsoever.
Let me ask you a question before you leave us. Because Brother Rel Daldell asked earlier about, you know, solutions that, you know, we could come up with, because the system is not going to come up with solutions. They're going to come up with locking us up. What do you, as a person that has went through trials and tribulations and have come through it, what do you recommend? Because there's other young folks that's going to follow that path. We know it. What do you recommend? How would you recommend men intervening, think tanks, groups? Well, what do you give us? Go ahead.
There are some groups out there you have to really dig deep for them, but black fathers against the child support system. There are some out here. There are some, but, you know, like what we don't support these groups, and we need these groups. It's groups out here to deal with that, but the person themselves has to be willing to get the help. You know what I mean? You got to be willing to ask for help, showing that you're vulnerable. Have more programs like this to let you know that our brothers are in jail for a whole bunch of nonsense, and it's nothing but slavery all over again. Brother Scotty Reed is absolutely right, and they tried to get me on that. It's just that I saw the way in the social engineering on how they try to play you against one another, and I didn't bite.
This is why, and this is why, when we in the black community have an opportunity to vote for judges and people, that we got to make sure we vote, because when your fate is in the hands of a judge, the judge has to be fair, right? I mean, let's just cut to the chase. When a judge takes an oath when they're sworn in office to be fair. That's the main thing. You have to be fair, whether it's a rich person in front of you or a homeless person in front of you. They should get equal treatment, right? So when a black man goes before a judge, that judge has to look at the situation and say, I'm going to be fair to this person, and not be, it could be a person who's even had issues themselves as a judge. You have to be able to put those things aside and give a fair assessment. A lot of times these brothers are being given very harsh penalties,
yep,
and that they can't recover from. If you put a black man who's not even working, you put him in jail for 90 days, and he comes out, he can't get a job after that. He was already having a hard time getting a job to begin with. How can he come out of jail now with a prison sentence and get a job? You've destroyed this person's confidence.
Well, you know, and you said one thing, the judge should, but I'm telling you right now, they don't. And I don't care who you vote for, what party you vote for, you're dealing with some criminal activity that are being, and you can see that they're working for somebody else. They're not working for justice or anything like they want us to believe. These are criminals that oversees the law system, and these judges are not fair. They're not just. They're nasty, racist pigs. And I'm telling you what I know because I dealt with them, and I've seen the penalty and the judgment they put on me. And here I am. I'm trying to do the right thing. So, no, brother. You know, this child support thing needs to be talked about more and more and more because I went through it. I see what it does to people, and they try to brick you. Now, there was one judge in the 90s when I divorced my first wife. He seen where she was making me call off for my job. He seen where she was just using the child support system or just calling me to court saying I wasn't doing this and I wasn't doing that to harass me. And he warned her. Now, I got to take my hat off to him. He said, next time I see you using this courtroom as your own personal vendetta against this man, I'm locking you up. I mean, that was about the only thing I saw that I could actually agree with. But other than that, man, look, all day long, I see the way these brothers are being railroaded and being trampled through these courts for petty nonsense. So, and I know another brother. He couldn't even go to Trinidad to attend his father's funeral because he's so much in arrears. And that man pushes 60, but he's in arrears. So he's like a prisoner to this country. He can't even fly off this country because he's still in arrears from something he did when he was 18, 19 years old. So, bro, I just wanted to, like.
Hello?
I'm here.
Yeah, you hear
me? Oh, I hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. Some women, they take it as I'm coming against them. No, I just don't. If I see the vindictiveness and the nastiness and how you're being socially engineered and being, you know, and the bitterness and how they use it, I speak on it. And it's nothing to do with you. It's nothing to do with misogynistic, because that was a word they threw around in the 90s. Nothing to do with us. If you're acting a fool, I'm going to tell you you're acting a fool. How you're being used by the system. So I mean, that's just where I'm at with that. So, you know, I just had to call in and let y'all know my experience with that now. So, you know, I'm sorry for taking up too much time, but I had to, like, give you my experience with that whole situation. And it even brought up some negative feelings that I'm going to have to deal with once I hang up, but that it is what it is. You know what I mean?
Brother, thanks for your call. And go and relax, man.
All right, now. Take care.
Peace. Brother L, I mean, let's hold on. Let me grab another one. 71719, Eric Hope.
Hey, how you doing, Brother Elliot?
Hey, sir. How are you?
How are you? I'm good, sir. Look, once again, I want to say what's up to Scotty Reed for even having a platform for you guys to put this stuff out. This is probably more therapeutic than most of the stuff I hear outside of the slavery conversation we should be having. Because to me, this child support is directly connected to it. My own experience, I'll tell it like this. 18, I was brought before the court because me and a young lady decided we had no future together. I was not given the opportunity to have an attorney. I was basically forced to sign saying this is your child. Not that I had any question. The process that I remember going through is that if the woman wanted benefits, welfare benefits, if she refused, she either was not going to get it or she had to lie about who. Most of the time, some of the women had to lie about the fact they don't even know who the father is. So that's one of the issues that was coming out of that. I can personally recall an issue with my situation where about 1997, when this is something I don't know if a lot of people are talking about or if it's been mentioned with the guests that you have on today, child support went out of the state-controlled hands into a federal privatized contracting So the agencies today aren't even state, they're not even state established. And this one little group has decided, CSEU, Child Support Enforcement Agency, or whatever they call itself, they're all about a federal internet, I mean a national movement. The reason why I found out from my own research, going in trying to fight with them, do everything that, you know, like this brother's talking about on the show today. When I went in to fight with them, they specifically did right in front of me. They took my daughter's mother right there in front of me and tried to coerce her into saying I was not paying anything. At this time, I'm all but about 22. And what I was doing, such as buying clothes, having my daughter as much as her mother was having her at my house, all these things were considered, as the child support says, as gifts. They didn't even say this was support. The only way we could be, it was deemed as support, is if we paid directly through the child support establishment, the process.
Okay.
Another thing I saw go down with child support in my time of dealing with it is, as we're all talking about, the jail, the punitive damages that come with it. I argued a judge, and another thing that doesn't get talked about is the women themselves, even if they're not for child support or trying to pursue it with this harassment type of method, they are given an attorney, which is the child support attorneys. That's who holds the contract for all these nationwide these child support cases. It's an attorney group. But anyway, as I was saying, I argued with the attorney, with the judge, about the concept that you're trying to jail me for this is not a crime. This is a municipal thing. This is a civil case. Where does the punitive damages how is it justified? And because child support always trying to put you on this, you need to pay by the 15th, for example, they'll suspend your license the day after, or put the process in to have your license suspended. My argument to the court was, I should have the allotted time to pay this child support within that 30 days. The judge did agree, so she made that part of my arrears. That's the sad thing about this. I'm still paying arrears from when I went to jail. When we try to file motions to go in and try to review, typically they will take the arrears and still treat it like they'll say it's not a current case, but they will treat it and use the guidelines for a active child support case. So that's why someone can be 60 years old still paying arrears. So, you know, these are things that are going on in that system that I myself have actually been fighting, and I'm glad. I'm so happy. I'm elated to hear this man putting out a documentary and addressing this issue. This is one that has brought problems into my own, my family, to my marriage that I've been married for 20 years. Because when the wife can't understand the process of child support, then she thinks that you're just being taken advantage of, which I agree. But they're thinking that we are just laying down, taking it, don't want to fight back. You know, we go in there, we're really unprepared. The court, I remember in my last situation when we were trying to wrap up my situation with my children, is that they were still trying to deem the children dependable up to the age of 25. Or here's one for you. If the child hasn't graduated by the age of 21, they can still claim child support for this child. But if the child is in school, now this is the state of Colorado I'm talking about, but if the child is still in school, they can continue to pursue an active case even after 21. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people's cases don't even go into arrears until their children are probably within damn near 30 years old. So that's a lot of what is going on that I've done my personal research for the state of Colorado and how the federal funding of the child support agency is going now as a privatized system. That's what I was able to understand and discover, that these are more or less like they keep these cases going so they can stay working. That's the easiest way I can say it. Thank you.
Ramon, listen, I want to thank you for your contribution, man. Before we let you go, Brother Rel,
yes, sir.
You heard Brother Ramon. You want to make any comment before I let him go?
You can tell, you know, he reminded me of the same outstanding and responsible brothers in the movie. Just this an issue that really needs to be discussed, that we, for some reason, black men haven't had a chance to have the platform to talk about it. And I think that if you did this show every week up until the film was released, you could get the same great feedback from different brothers. I mean, I just think that it's something that really is crippling our people, and it's to hear the brother here and the brother before that, it's the same. I mean, they had the same passionate tone, and you can say it's coming from the heart. You can tell when somebody is speaking from the heart, and both of those brothers, you could tell it's something that it's a pain that just doesn't go away. It's like arthritis or something like that. I mean, even if you try to treat it, it's never going to go away fully, because it's always going to bring pain at the worst possible time. And I just think that too many black men who really want to be good parents or would have been outstanding parents, I think that the system has crippled them to really be that the father that they need to be to really save the black family. I mean, the father really is a cornerstone for a reason. It's like that old song by the OJs, Family Reunion, when he says, you know, the father is the rock of the family, by the OJs. Once you take that rock away, though, the family is going to have a hard time. And I think that the black father is someone who does not get enough credit in society. And I think when you make his job harder by putting him in front of the courtroom system that's not giving him a fair shake, you don't just hurt him, even though you think it's hurting just the black man. You really hurt the whole black family structure. It's not just you hurting the black man to be a good father. You're decimating that whole family, generation after generation after generation.
And that's the intent of that legal system.
Ramon,
thanks for your call, man.
Well, Brother Elliot, can I ask Brother Rel this question?
Go ahead.
I'm muted out. Brother Rel, were you able to discover what I found out about child support? It was actually a process invented for rich men. Rich white men, to be exact, who were leaving their wives, you know, with all these riches, but with no, they basically would just take off and say, hey, you know, figure it out for yourself. Did you discover that information?
I didn't know. That's powerful, because, like I said, you know, it was a vision I had, brother, and to just let black men speak about it. And what I did was, it was like I would sit in front of the brothers, and I had some questions that I wanted to ask. And then once I started asking questions about, it's the same one every time I said, once I was like, tell me your experience with the child support system, their whole expression would change. I would say, what's your name, brother? What do you do for a living? Da-da-da-da. Then I would, the gun would be, well, tell me your experience. And once I said that, just like when you emoted earlier, that's when, and no one ever mentioned anything about, you know, well, Caucasian men. They were just speaking from a catharsis point. I was in jail, and they came and snatched me up from my job, and I went in front of this judge, and I was in jail with a rapist, and I went to an Ivy League school, but I was still, I mean, it was like, and after a while, I was like, even though these brothers are from a different points of the socioeconomic spectrum, they all had the same trouble.
Brother Rel, you mind if I, Brother Elliot and Richard, do y'all mind if I share something that I feel like this would be my codification to a situation like that? Is it okay if I do that?
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What I found out for brothers that's trying to work for them, I mean, that have got some marketable skills, they can kind of go out as independent contractors. They may already know this, but I'll share it anyway. One way to protect yourself from the child support getting into your income, specifically when you know you're trying to make all ends meet, if you set yourself up as you can incorporate your own name, or you can even sole proprietor your own name as a business. Right. And the state, I had a standoff with the state of Colorado about this, to the point where I had to actually set myself up as a, well, I am a business, but I'm saying in order to keep and prevent child support from digging into my private accounts, I just had to set myself up with an EIN. Right. Recently, I've learned about foundations, which I'm not trying to help somebody be a deadbeat father. That's not what I'm trying to do. Because like myself, I continue to pay on my arrears. I have no reason to want to run from it. Point is, it just seems like they really don't want you to pay this debt off. They'll find any way and every way to try to harass you about being a week or two behind. So I found out over the last 6 months, you can set yourself up as a business with a trust, with a trustee and a foundation, and that can protect these brothers from having their finances screwed with. I'm not saying this to have them out here trying to be deadbeat fathers, because I don't agree with that. I just simply agree with the fact that going through that process myself, I'm 43. This started with me at 18, so I'm speaking from a personal point of view. I saw the court system turn from, I don't think it was ever good. That's why I brought up if Brother Rel had read that, this was a system actually invented for rich white men running off leaving their families. And then they figured out how to use it towards us.
Right.
One thing I don't like, though, is that we're not actively pursuing, and this is would be to the men that are on child support. I will say this. This is my own. When my wife would push me into the point of write letters, go push it, keep going after them as much as they come after you, you do start to see a change. And I can honestly say that. You'll start seeing a change in, well, you know, you can't call and harass me. This is like a debtor's prison process you're doing. You know, you start having responses like that towards them, they start to they approach you with a different process then. They don't start yelling jail no more. The one that does seem to be very difficult to get out of their hands is the suspension of your license. I'm still looking at what statutes we could use to kind of prevent that from happening as well. And to take it out of the hands of a debtor's prison. So if anybody's on this line that are suffering the same situations I, like many other black men, are, we could all collectively find that answer. How can we take, or what statutes do they have out there that prevent them from tampering with your employment through your license and things like that? That's probably the number one reason most men end up unemployed dealing with child support. Thank you, and I'll mute my line. Mm-hmm.
If I can, because I did read that what Brother Raymond said, Brother Rawl and Brother Elliot, about if the system was initially generated for middle class white men, and if I can just run off those rules, which also Brother Raymond made the point about how the federal laws got in place. And that took it to more level, especially I see around the Clinton area. In 75, President Ford enacted the Title IV-D child support system designed to reimburse states for public assistance. And in 1986, Congress enacted the Brady Amendment. Child support orders could not be forgiven or reduced. These are federal laws, right? 1996, the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act required employers to report new employees so that they could be matched against the child support orders to enforce automatic wage garnishing. In 1998, Clinton signed into law the Deadbeat Parent Punishment Act, which created a new category for federal felonies, and the Child Support Performance Incentive Act. This act penalized states for failure to meet data processing requirements. So now the feds are saying, if you don't give me the data on them, I'm going to come after you. So you can see, and especially we know that, especially by the time Clinton came in, they were consolidating and downsizing the public assistance requirements for women, and women and children. And so on one hand, pulling away public assistance from women and children, and on the other hand, putting in federal law to go after and in garnishing the making felonies of these from the child support system for the men, and making sure that the state actually gives them the data so they know who they are supposed to go after in their state from a federal perspective. So I think that even though it may have started out for white men, and the difference is that more white men, those middle-class white men that were leaving those families, they had the economic foundation to pay. Of black men in general didn't have the economic foundation to be able to pay the child support system. And that's why it seemed to me it comes off just like what the police do in writing these tickets to help finance the counties by penalizing black men in cars who are driving, giving them unnecessary tickets so that they could be able to collect these fees. And in this case, the child support system is another way to collect these fees. Or as Brother Raymond said, and has said in relationship to actually putting us into debtor's prison, because that's what it really, we become debtor's servants, because we never can really pay off the state what we owe. And that's why it's so important, as Brother Raul, your documentary shows, that we as individual men, we as individual fathers are responsible, want to do, that we'll go through, even at our own self-sacrificing from a financial, to make sure that we are able to pay, even if we can't. But that's also why it's a political issue. And black men, once we take it and stop making it personal, once we have this dialogue that you're talking about, then we can actually do the political acts of looking up those legislations, of selecting the right judges, of changing those laws. And when we can't do that, then taking it to whatever that next step is.
Let me go to this 267 area code. 267. 267.
Yes, peace.
Yes, go ahead, caller.
That's Brother Oba.
This is Brother Oba.
Oh, calling. Brother Oba. Hold the line, Brother Oba.
I will.
I'm great. Okay. Great. Okay. You know, listen, you've heard from a few callers, Brother Dell, Brother Rel, and I think that your documentary might be very impactful nationwide to a lot of black men and women, because I think this conversation needs to be had, and they got to realize that there's a system out there that's intent to destroy black families and pit one against the other, and they've been successful. But the solution to this problem is going to have to come from us, and it might come from your documentary being screened in churches, being screened at community groups, being screened at black civic organizations. Everybody needs to sit down, watch this documentary, and then have some serious talk afterwards, because it's not only affecting.
Richard, when it comes out, we need to do this again. You know what I mean? And before we have the release date and pick it up and so people will know. You know, and I agree with you. They'll start it all up again.
Well, the door is always open to you, brother. And listen, before I let you go. You talked about your first film,
yes.
A Train Wire, was the last film that Esther Roll did.
Yes.
You know that Esther Roll was an iconic actress among black folks, and near the end of her life, she made what a lot of whites consider controversial statements about acting and blacks in acting, and whites controlling of acting. What was your impressions of Miss Rowe in her waning years? You know, I'm not sure how long it was after her completion of that film that she passed. But talk about your impressions of Miss Rowe.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I always wanted every chance I get to talk about how much she meant to myself and what I'll do today. It was, you know, when I met her, she was already pretty ill. And when we did the train ride, the feature version of it, I remember her doctor called me. And the doctor was like, what's your name, young man? I said, Roe Dowdell. He said, are you related to Miss Roe? He said, are you her son? Are you her nephew? I was like, no. I said, I'm a filmmaker who, you know, she says, well, she has a great deal of devotion to you, young man. She wants to go against her dialysis treatment here on Monday to fly to be in your film. And I'm advising her not to come, you know, because she's on dialysis and it could endanger her. But I wanted to talk to you to see who you were. and she came. She flew up here from L.A. and we shot the film at Cheney University, and she played the dean of the college. And I remember on a set, she would sit down, and I had to help her up. I had to lift her up out of her chair and walk her to where we – when you shoot a film, everybody has a mark. You put an X on the ground, and that's where you stand for the scene so the camera doesn't go haywire when you're shooting. And I had to lift her up. I would take her to the mark. And then she would do her lines like she did on Good Times, with flawless acting. Then when I say cut, she would stumble. I had to pick her back up and take her back to her chair. And this is an independent film where, you know, we're not even paying nearly the amount of wages that you should get on a Hollywood movie. But Esther Rolle, to me, was a symbol of the old-school mentality that we as blacks need today, of those who were not afraid to give back to others who deserve help, right? I mean, that's the one thing that Esther Rolle taught me is, like, no matter, you know, what you've done or what you've accomplished, it's the right thing to do to reach back and send the elevator back down to someone else who wants to come up if they're deserving of the opportunity. So, you know, I went to her funeral and I sat next to the brother that was on What's Happening, Ernest Thomas, who played Raj, and we were both, you know, emotional wrecks because it was, you know, we both talked about how what she meant to not just her and to us, but to the whole black community. I mean, Esther Rolle was a real maternal figure in the 70s, and I think it's a testament that show still is on today. It's as popular today as it is. I mean, it comes on now more than it did back when it was on in its prime. It comes on like 4 or 5 times a day, and I think that's a testament to not just Esther Rolle, but also the fact that if it wasn't for Esther Rolle, John Amos would never have been on the show, because she's the reason why John Amos got a job, because when the show was conceived, it was not meant to have a black father in the show. But she told Norman Lear, I don't want to have a show where you just have a single black mother raising children by herself. We need a black father on here, and he should be a strong black father. And that's how John Amos got the job. So Esther Rolle did a great deal to save. Imagine Good Times without the father on the show. I mean, imagine Good Times to this day without the character of James Evans on it. It's a totally different show.
And she also objected vehemently when they put him off the show.
They killed him off. Remember that? They killed him off with no explanation. This one day he's dead. You know, he didn't come back from a trip or something like that. And that caused a great deal of dissension on that set as well. But she's still by her principles, and we need more of that in our community. I think we need to learn from people like Esther Rolle to make our community better.
Brother Rel, I want to thank you for being with us. I'm looking forward to the release of the film. When is it scheduled?
I want to get it out by the end of the year. I'll let you know as soon as I get a release date. That, you know, like I said, I wanted the trailer to start a buzz, which I thank God that you and Richard have seen it, and other people have seen it as well. I want to talk about it. You know, just go to YouTube and put in Where's Daddy movie trailer. It comes right up, and I'm definitely going to have a release date on that trailer as soon as I can. But I'm glad the dialogue is starting, because I think that anticipation for any movie in our community that helps uplift us is beneficial. And I just hope that the right people, like you said, see it. So when it does come out, it does start that dialogue, whether it has a group of people or a church group or a community group, and people say, you know what, this film is going to start bringing dialogue in our community that we haven't had before between black men and black women to help bridge that gap, to bring some well-needed change.
I want to thank you for being with us, man, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, Rich. All right, Rella. Thank you, brothers.
All right.
Peace.
God bless. All right.
We'll be right back. Second portion of our program, Brother Oba Olainga, the 13th Annual African Independence Day Celebration here in Philadelphia at Malcolm X Park, 52nd and Pine Street, August 5th. We'll be in discussion with Brother Oba right after the brief break. We'll be right back.
are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
That says there's a zero quota on blacks coming into the country, but it'll be a white country for white Europeans only. Now, in the Constitution, here's how the coding started working. The coding came up, they says, all the people. Every time the white society says, all the people, we the people, the American people, they are not talking about you. You are the people to be excluded. That's why in the Constitution, there's no place in the Constitution, not in one instance, does it ever mention the word slave. Never does it include the word slavery. Whenever they want to start talking about black folk in the Constitution starting out in the 1600s and 1700s, what they said is they used very broad and ambiguous terms to relate to black folk, like those who are indebted, those who are abundant. That species of property, to make sure that what they're deciding, and they use this when they met to form the Constitution of Philadelphia in 1779, when all the so-called founding fathers got together, what they said is this: let's not taint this document we're getting ready to create called the Constitution. Let's not taint it talking about slavery or about slaves. We're getting ready to screw over some people, but we don't want anybody to know about it. We want to leave no fingerprints. No fingerprints should be left on what we're getting ready to do. This is fact. For the first 3 days in the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, they kept the doors locked while they all debated whether or not slave and slavery should show up in the Constitution and what terms they should use. And they went out of their way to say that nobody ought to use those terms. We will use very broad and ambiguous terms. So when Thomas Jefferson rewrote the Constitution, he had to write it three times to make sure that there was nothing left in there, no fingerprints left of what was going to happen to a certain group of people. And so when you read the Constitution, it says, we the people you just had. All the people you just had. When the Constitution said that all men are created equal, they weren't talking about you. Because at the same time in the Constitution said all the people are equal. They had already classified in the Constitution that you would be a three-fifths of a human being. They weren't talking about you. But somehow, my people never understand that. They talk about the Constitution, what they call the founding fathers. The fathers, finally, fathers knew the game. They set that up in the Constitution so that they can always track that with no fingerprints. When they said in the Constitution, for instance, that all people are created equal, they've been endowed by their God to have inalienable rights. To what? To life, liberty, and what? No, that's what it got you again. It wasn't for the pursuit of happiness. It was pursuit of property. They switched on you. Initially, it was supposed to be the pursuit of property. Nobody on this earth got past the third grade without thinking people, white folks, that foolish to come across the oceans in 3 months and sailing on a boat with barely enough food and water to live and come to the United States looking for happiness.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for Awakening. I want to thank Brother Rel Daldell, filmmaker, hometown brother. The documentary, Where's Daddy, will be out before this year is out. We're going to keep the listening audience aware of what's going on, so these things can be talking points in every city, in every town, in every neighborhood where we dwell at, so we can come up with solutions to bridge this gap, to bring families back together. But we need to talk about these things first. And I just want to thank him for being on with us. Go to YouTube, but you can go to Time for Awakening Facebook page. The documentary is up there. Click, and you can see the link for the trailer. We're looking forward to having Brother Daldell back on at a later time. We're transitioning into the second part of our program with a guest that has been on recently before, activist, organizer, and co-founder of the African Independence Day celebration here in Philly. It'll be held on August 5th at Malcolm X Park at 52nd and Pine Street. Brother Oba Olayinka is with us. Brother Oba.
Peace, Brother Elliot. Thank you. Thank you for having me on again.
How are you, sir?
I'm well. I'm here with my partner, also part of the African Independence Day organizing committee, Brother Kamua, and I have him here with me. So we're very honored and blessed to be your guest tonight on Time for Awakening. Thank you for having us back.
Brother Oba, let our listening audience know, because it's a broad audience. It's folks from outside the local area, but they might decide to come in. Tell our listening audience what there'll be things that'll be in store for them when they come to Malcolm X Park at 52nd and Pine for the African Independence Day celebration, the 13th annual, mind you.
Of course. Definitely we are poised to be having our 13th annual African Independence Day Mott celebration here in Philadelphia, which will take place Saturday, August the 5th. At Malcolm X Memorial Park, which is located in the West Philadelphia section of the city at 52nd and Pine Streets from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. We plan to have, our celebration this year planned to be very, very big, probably the biggest and the best that we've had yet. On the docket, we have a lot of people on our rostrum that will be performing and speaking, the likes of United Front, as well as the hip-hop group Oshun, Dr. James Small, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., Sister Denise Valentine, Universal African Dance and Drum Ensemble from Camden, as well as Mama Pam Africa, Brother IJ Tiembe from New York City, who teaches at the Harlem Liberation School, as well as the UNIA ACL president, the Honorable Michael Duncan, Brother Ifa Tunde Fayemi, another great hip-hop rapper by the name of Brother Richard Raw, Brother Tahir RBG, the Urban Shamans, African Dance and Drum Ensemble called Kamara Arts, as well as Sister Jazara and the Moonshadow Band. We plan to have a children's pavilion, a health and wellness pavilion, and an education pavilion, as well as an African marketplace. And also we plan to have our first annual award honoring the founder of African Independence Day, Brother Ahmed Akil Tahir. We plan to have an award in his honor. He had a store called the Pearl of Africa, and so we're going to have our first annual Pearl of Africa award presentation at this year's celebration. And in addition to that, as well as our Marcus Garvey Parade, which will be taking place earlier in the day from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., from 52nd and Arch Streets to we will process all the way to the park, Malcolm X Memorial Park, the site of African Independence Day at 52nd and Pine Streets. And that will begin once again at 10 a.m. and it will conclude at Malcolm X Park at 12 p.m.
Brother Oba, what the first annual parade that's being convened in remembrance of Marcus Garvey, is it a children's parade or it's a mixture of children and adults? Or?
It's a mixture of children and adults. We are doing this this parade as well as African Independence Day in conjunction with the UNIACL, Universal Negro Improvement Association, African Communities League here in Philadelphia, Divisions 121 and 178. So we will be honoring the honorable, or should I say the right excellent honorable, Marcus Mosiah Garvey, and it will be a multi-generational event. So we will have men, women, and children, our elders, tweeners, as well as our youth out there processing throughout the streets of West Philadelphia in the business corridor of 52nd Street.
I have to say, Elliot, you know, me being a member of Division 121 in Philadelphia, I've seen Brother Oba's name recently in doing some work there as the part of the Council of Elders. So it's interesting and honorable to see that they're in pulling together as African Africa Day that this parade in honor to Marcus Mosiah Garvey is being done, and that the President General Duncan will be presenting at this event. I think that it's a testament to Brother Obaz and the other organizers work in bringing forward Mr. Garvey's program and helping to develop the outreach of the UNIA through the nation and therefore in the city and in the division.
Yeah, I mean, I'm you know, one of the things is that there would be no red, black, and green. There would be no African Liberation Flag if it wasn't for the Right Excellent Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. I myself am a member of the UNIA ACL Division 178, and when we were formulating this year's celebration, I was approached by Sister Sese Mama Basima Muhammad Bey, who is currently our fourth Assistant President General of the UNIA, to talk about bringing back the Garvey Parade. So what we decided to do was, instead of having two separate events, which she helped to bring about the first Garvey Parade in 2004 under the leadership of the Honorable Redmond Battle, our former president general of the UNIA, I said, well, that's a great idea, you know, to be able to merge the Garvey Parade with African Independence Day, since she was a very instrumental part of helping to bring about African Independence Day at its inception back in 2004 as well. So we just decided to combine efforts together, representing red, black, and green, representing race-first ideology as well as do-for-self ideology. And that's why this year the parade is entitled the Marcus Garvey Do-for-Self Junkanoo Parade. So we've added a little bit of flavor of our a little bit of, should I say, Caribbean flavor with our Junkanoo Parade, understanding that Junkanoo is a tradition that started in the Caribbean. It is a smaller version of a carnival because Junkanoo was started by, you know, the basic, you know, current brothers and sisters that, you know, didn't have a whole lot of money. You know, Junkanoo was a little bit more elaborate, a little bit more extravagant, and, you know, it's a lot of, you know, money put into Junkanoo to make costumes. I mean, excuse me, into carnival to make costumes, but brothers and sisters who didn't have that type of money just, you know, utilize the resources that they had around them, bottles, sticks, you know, making, you know, little handmade instruments and things of that nature. And sisters would make, you know, costumes from their homes to celebrate. So basically, Junkanoo is a little smaller version of carnival done by the so-called, you know, I guess, common brother, average everyday brothers and sisters in the Caribbean. So we wanted to add that flavor in to the existing Garvey Parade.
Brother Oba, you know, the parade, the whole celebration in itself, do you notice a transformation in the neighborhood in regards to your efforts? And the best way to know the transformation in my eyes, and you can talk about it from your perspective as a person that is doing the work, the best way to see the fruits of your labor is to see fruit. And when I say fruit, I'm talking about young people starting to get involved. You got Ron Green in that area, I think on 52nd Street, that's been doing things with the RBG and some of the young people up there. Do you notice more and more young people being involved, joining, getting involved, knowing who Marcus Garvey was, what he tried to do? Tell me how this is really translating into something that you can see growing.
I like to answer that question. This is Brother Kamua, one of the organizers of this event.
Hey, bro.
Chase, we held a meeting last week at the at a community center down in West Philly. And as I was walking down 52nd Street on my way there, I ran into a young brother. His brother had to be around the age of, I believe, 18 or his 20s. Just on site, the brother engaged me, asked me where I was going, and I just happened to have some flyers with me. I passed him the flyers, and, you know, the flyer is a beautiful flyer. It has Marcus Garvey, several pictures of Marcus Garvey's, red, black, and green. The brother's face lit up. I mean, he was immediately excited. I mean, from where he was standing, he said, "I'm coming with you." So on Wednesday, we have an organizing meeting where we are preparing for the parade. We're looking for participants. We're looking for volunteers to participate, and the brother was just with it. As I arrived at the center, there were three young ladies, and I was just so pleased to see these young women. Once again, very young, you know, I believe from the age of 18 to their early 20s. And, you know, to see them, you know, there early before I even arrived, you know, it was absolutely excellent. And it was a validation that the work that we've been putting in for these years are finally paying off. And we see the receptivity of the youth, you know, coming around. So one of the young ladies who was involved, she actually, you know, went on her social media. She put together a video, a short video promoting this event. And these young people are quite active in the community themselves. So I want to definitely say yes. I see the fruits of our labor. I see the spirit of Marcus Garvey and the UNIA living on with the future generations to come.
And either one of you men can speak to this issue, and probably Brother Oba might know it a little bit more. Professor Smalls, Fred Hampton Jr., who were both former guests on the program, will they be talking about anything specific, or just welcoming the people in general and just talking about the gathering in itself?
Well, one of the things that we strive to do is that we're putting together now and assembling is to, of course, have them amongst the brothers and sisters on the rostrum at African Independence Day on that Saturday. But we're also on that Sunday putting together a lecture to be held at the UNIAACL hall on 16th and Cecil B. Moore in the North Philadelphia section of the city, Division 121, Thomas W. Harvey Division, which is international headquarters for the UNIA, that Sunday to begin at approximately maybe 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. We're putting the final preparations in to have a lecture with just those two individuals. We plan to have a packed house and raise some money with some of the proceeds going to the restoration of Division 121 located on 16th and Cecil B. Moore, as we have been working diligently and very, very hard to try to restore the building, especially the third floor and the second floor of the building. To be utilized as well as to do some restoration work on the first floor. So, so we're utilizing that space, and we're striving to utilize the entire African Independence Day, my celebration weekend, to raise some money and at the same time give brothers and sisters in Philadelphia, in the Delaware Valley area, the greater Delaware Valley area, an opportunity to sit down, listen to, and dialogue with both Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. and Professor Smalls.
You know, Brother Oba, one of the things that we're also a part of, one in a million conscious and conscientious Black voters and contributors, and when we were discussing in our meeting about how could we participate, one of the questions came up, you know, we do one of our major planks, or one of the planks, is having voter registration drive to have people register as non-party affiliation. And we was wondering, would those that kind of activity also be allowed to be done at that day?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I'm not necessarily a man on a personal level that believes in voting. I remember last year when the election came up, and there were individuals who came to the park and set up without our permission, didn't ask and weren't invited to set up set up a table driving to gain votes for Hillary Clinton. And we had go back and forth with them about setting up their table. I'm neither Democratic nor Republican, but if, like you say, setting up a nonpartisan table, that necessarily, and I'm not necessarily an independent party either. I'm just a race first man that's about, the red, black, and green party. So, if it's, something dealing with nonpartisan or just striving to get, information out about, voting as a nonpartisan individual, I don't necessarily see that as being a problem. I know that that's probably something that I would have to sit down and talk with and confer with my committee, because we make decisions what is best for the committee and the event itself. So I strive not to make unilateral decisions all by myself. So that's something that we would have to discuss and definitely get back with you on.
And that's respected, which raises an interesting point, Elliot and Brother Oban, because I'm wondering, one of the questions I have for you is the Africa Day a coalition activity, or is it, as you say, you've been doing it for 13 years, is it an activity that is basically a organizational activity that is, that is driving it? And rephrasing the same question is other organizational organizations involved in helping to make the event a success also?
To answer that question is really to go back to the beginning in the genesis of African Independence Day, which started back in 2004. And African Independence Day started as an outgrowth of what formerly was the Coalition of African People's Unity, which became the Nation of African People's Unity and was founded by Brother Ahmed Akil Tahir, owner of the Pearl of Africa Gates of Zion, which was located on 624 South Street for 19 years. He was an activist. He was a thought leader. He was a freedom fighter, and he was very much a race first man. Who I met back in college. And so he and I forged a strong relationship over the years, and he came to me one day and said, you know, we need to formulate an umbrella coalition working with the existing organizations that are about the liberation and sovereignty of African people. It doesn't matter, you know, what they represent, because it's not a religious organization. It is a coalition to do collective work in the community. And so we started the Coalition of African People's Unity, which became later on the Nation of African People's Unity. And as an outgrowth of it came African Independence Day to introduce the coalition to the greater Philadelphia area. And so we designated Malcolm X Park. We had our first African Independence Day celebration back in the back in August of 2004. We decided to do it on the first Saturday in the month of August, which we've done it ever since. And so it just grew from there. And although the Nation of African People's Unity as a collective umbrella organization or coalition no longer exists, the ideas of the Nation of African People's Unity, the ideas of Brother Ahmed Tahir, who passed away due to cancer back in May of 2012, still exists. We usually, as a people, we don't do a good job in, the fact that, when we bury, when we bury the man or bury the one man, we also bury the plan. What we need to get used to is continuing institutions and various different events that were started by individuals, either man or woman. You know, we bury the man, we bury the woman, but we continue to plan. And that was the idea when Brother Ahmed had made transition was to continue this this idea that he espoused and that he lived for and that he very much in transition still represents. And so, I took it upon myself along with, a small committee to continue that work. And in working, we found, partnership with the UNIA. We found partnership with various different organizations who help in their own way to help bring about this celebration, and we hope to have more. We hope to go out and solicit funding from Black-owned, Black-operated businesses. We don't want European-owned corporate sponsorship involved in any way in African Independence Day. We believe in our autonomy and our sovereignty. We believe that if we choose to have anybody speak or perform, that we're not censored, that we're not told what or how to go about doing things, because when you take corporate monies from outside sources, especially European-owned and European-ran, then the festival or the event or parade or anything that you do suddenly no longer is in your hands, but is actually in their hands, and they dictate to you how to go about doing things. So we are about African people. We're Race First Men. It's for us. It's by us as African people, as black people. So to answer your question.
Brother Omar, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation. And you can join the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Brother Oba Olayinka is with us this evening, the 13th Annual African Independence Day Celebration here in Philly at Malcolm X Park at 52nd and Pine Street on August 5th. We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kamban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black, and the green around me. For in the new life, I shall rise up with God's grace and blessing to lead the millions up the heights and the triumph that you well know. Look for me in a world when there is storm. Look for me all around you, for with God's grace, I shall come back with countless millions of black men and women who have died in America, those who have died in the West Indies, and those who have died in Africa, to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave. They gave leadership to our foreparents, and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars have inspired through the colleges, the universities, have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards. You race of imbeciles. You race of good for nothing. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die. Can we do it?
Yes.
We can do it.
Yes.
We will. We shall do it.
Yes.
We have prayed to God for vision and for leadership.
Yes.
And He has given us our universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies. But a vision that said there must be a free and redeemed Africa.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're in conversation this evening with Brother Oba Olayinka, one of the co-founders of the 13th Annual African Independence Day Celebration, which will be held in Philadelphia on August 5th. At Malcolm X Park, 52nd and Pine Street, in the West Philadelphia section. Brother Oba?
Yes, sir.
And, you know, I'm always bad on names till I hear them about two, three times. The other brother, what's his name again?
Brother Kamua.
Brother Kamua. The title in itself, African Independence Day Celebration. Let's talk about that a little bit, and I'd like both you and Brother Kamua's opinions on this. The word independence to me means self-sufficient. Two of the things that go along with independence, and Marcus Garvey, the Honorable Marcus Garvey, talked a little bit about it in that clip that I played, was self-governing. And I'm adding being able to protect ourselves. Two of the things that's going, and I'm going to divert a little bit from the celebration, but we can always tie it in. Two of the things that's going on now that we really have to look seriously at because it affects our young people directly. It affects all of us indirectly, but is really aimed as a loaded gun aimed at our young people is these wanton police murders in urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas across this country. In my opinion, I think that we really have to learn or develop means to protect our communities. And I'm not necessarily talking about aggressively going at the police, but I'm talking about monitoring the police, policing the police, and policing our communities, which means a total mindset change for a minority of people in our communities that want to conduct themselves like fools. Talk about the necessity in your mind to start developing means, whether it's self-discipline, whether it's bringing brothers and sisters in that used to be involved in the armed forces, whether it's bringing people from the Nation of Islam in to teach self-discipline so we can learn how to gather together, young men, older men as a unifying force to start patrolling and protecting our communities. I'd like your opinions on that, Brother Oba and Brother Kamua.
It's interesting that you raised that question, Brother Elliot. Today, I attended our mass meeting at the UNIACL on 16th and Cecil B. Moore, Division 121, Thomas W. Harvey Division, International Headquarters. And the question that was being raised during the lesson today was talking about African warriorhood or establishing a warrior class within our community. And how to go about doing that, because this was some of the things that Mr. Garvey was talking about, and we were talking about one of the chapters in the book Race First, by Tony Martin. So we were talking about that, and one of the things I said was that I go back to an African proverb that women and children make up the garden, and that the men are the fence around that garden, meaning that the garden is representative of the village, and you have women and you have children, and that the fence is representative of the protection of that garden, representing the men as well as sisters, because you know, not only do we have brothers who are warriors, but we have sisters who are warriors. And a soldier, you know, is a highly skilled warrior. So that's a different kind of warrior, but we're talking about warriors in general. So where it starts at, I believe, Brother Elliot, is that it starts at home. And it starts really in the establishment of rites of passage with young people. I think that as in dealing with young people, first and foremost, we have to have a clear definition and understanding of what rites of passage is. Because one of the problems that we have is that we don't have a whole lot of clear definitions on things. And that leads to confusion. And confusion leads us astray or leads us to go awry on the mission that we and course that we really need to be on. So we have to become clear in definition of what rites of passage really is. And what I mean by rites of passage is not only the scholarship and the education that young people are getting about who and what they are, where they come from, their origin in this world, understanding their relationship to God and their ancestors, but also understanding some life skills, some survival skills. We are a people who are not in war. We are a people who are not at war. We are people that are being warred upon. So, and this is according to Mama Marimba Ani, writer of the book Yorugu, which I very much believe, because we have not done a good job in coming up with an effective strategy to defend ourselves and defend ourselves from white supremacy and global European imperialism. So we're being warred upon until we come up with an effective strategy to deal with European global imperialism. So my thing is that we have to deal with the youth and understand what rites of passage is. So we have to go out and teach our children how to hunt, how to gather, how to be able to build a fire, how to be able to build shelter out in the wilderness, how to be able to deal with some survival skills. And I'm talking about putting them out there where on their own, they have to find ways in which to be able to survive. We are in a warlike stance, and so we have to take it as such. And we have to have a unified definition around the board, not only here in Philadelphia, but all around the country and even all around the world and Africans throughout the diaspora, of what rites of passage is, and begin to implement it with our children, not just in the classroom, but we have to give them literal survival skills in how to be able to take care of themselves, defend themselves, and defend their family and their community. But also with the adults, I think that we as adults have to become more independent in mind and in action. What I mean is that we got to find ways to come up off of the 9-to-5 plantation. We got to start developing institutions where as though businesses and things of that nature where we can be totally self-sufficient. The more self-sufficient you are, the more time that you have to dedicate towards the work of liberation and nation building. When you work an 8-hour day, a job from 9 to 5, the best hours of your day are spent working in the best interest of this system. When you come home from work, you're tired. And most, I mean, especially for those of us who have children, now, I mean, you gotta, you know, help them with, you gotta cook dinner, help them with homework, you know, wash your children up, get them in bed, and then you gotta turn around and take care of the things that you need to take care of. And there's not enough hours in the day to really do the work of liberation, the work of nation building, by the time 9:30, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock comes along. So the best hours of your day, the best hours of your week are spent working in behalf of striving to build up this system instead of building a system of your own. And so we got to learn how to free ourselves up to do the work of liberation on a full-time basis. Can't be a part-time person in this thing. You have to be a full-time person. And that's the challenge that we have. And that's what, you know, I myself and even my brothers are striving to do, become more independent so that we can do the real work that counts instead of the work that, you know, helping to build up someone else's system. So those are two of the things that I was raising today. And those are just some of the things, as well as others, but we don't have that much time to really get into it. But I'm just going to, you know, say that for now.
Yeah, I like that. Go ahead, Brother Grimaud.
Yeah, I like to add on to some of the things that Oba said, but I would like to say some things in regards to personal discipline. I think that one who takes the stance on defense in regards to his family and his community must demonstrate a degree of discipline, self-discipline, and their daily routine, regiment, their conditioning,
okay,
their physical fitness.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are a number of things, you know, within our communities and services that people offer in regards to conditioning yourself and being able to link up with other individuals who have this sort of mindset that we need to be in a preparedness place in an event that we need to defend ourselves. So I think that working with youth most of my adult life, I think that it is primarily important to instill in youth a sense of character, a sense of purpose, have them identify a sense of purpose. Once they identify a sense of purpose, they begin to value things at a different standpoint. I think that once we can, you know, instill these things and put these things in place, and if we do it in a collective way, continue to work with other individuals who have this similar mindset, we then are in a place to properly maintain our families and our community.
Okay, let's Richard, I know you want to jump in, but let me take a call. 602 area code 602.
Yes, brothers. Good evening, Brother Richard, and Brother Elliot, and Brother Oba, and Brother Kamua. I'd like to talk this evening. This is Brother Marcus from Memphis.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right, man. This talk is good talk. You see what I'm saying? This talk, we should talk this every week because this talk is solution. You know what I'm saying? And you know, Marcus Garvey was the man with the plan. You see, everybody came, every other ethnic group came after Garvey and organized themselves from Garvey's program, you know. You know, the Chinese, they came and they ran with Garvey's program, you know. The Indians came, they ran with Garvey's program. Just us black people didn't run with the program, but now I see us bringing Mr. Garvey's program to the forefront because that is the solution. There is no solution for us here in America. We should just use this place as a place to gather technology and capital and go build our continent, develop trade with our people in Colombia, in Brazil, in Jamaica, in Africa. We tie it all in together. That was the purpose of Garvey getting those ships. And you notice as soon as he made the move to get the ships, that's when the system moved on him immediately. They said, no, you can't let him get no ships because once we begin trade with each other, then we're going to pull ourselves up economically. And they don't want that, you see? But to hell with what they want is what we want now. We can't, because they would like to just for us to lay down and die. You know what I'm saying? But I am proud of these brothers here. And, you know, I like this talk. And we should turn our conversation to solutions. You know, we talk about the blues. We know the problems. We are overwhelmed with the problems. But now we can just focus on the solution because, see, as the brother was saying earlier, the one about child support, this entire system is a prison. You don't have to go to jail. It's the whole U.S. society is a prison. USA, my larger prison. You go to the doctor, the medical system, you don't even know if you got cancer. You know, you go to the doctor, oh, yeah, you got cancer. I got to give you this radiation. I got to give you this chemotherapy. That kill you more than whatever you have faster. The food we eat, we don't know. We don't manufacture that food. We don't know what we eat now for that shelf. The clothes we wear, we know smallpox. They use smallpox and kill out a whole bunch of red men, right? The educational system, you know that, well, that's definitely miseducation. And the last protection, we can't call the police to protect us because we may end up being the victim. So we got to either break out of the prison or burn down the prison. You take care.
Thank you for your contribution, Brother Marcus.
All right.
Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, I was, Brother Oba, for the African Independence Day, What is the outcome you would like to see at the end of the event for this year?
Well, not just for this year, but for every year. Our mission statement says that our mission addresses the significance of sovereignty, autonomy, and economic empowerment throughout the diaspora of African people. By utilizing this platform, we will be able to engage intergenerational leadership by way of an annual international summit to be held here each August in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That is one of the goals that we have here in African Independence Day. And out of that summit, to begin to do the work of nation building, to become sovereign and autonomous Africans, to understand the importance, the significance, the history of maroonage and why maroonage is the way, is the only answer for African people's independence and autonomy. That has to be clear. The Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey said it, and us repatronizing ourselves back to Africa. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said it in his way of African people or black people having land or a nation that they can call their own. But we believe that separation is the only answer for African people's survival and maintenance, maintaining ourselves as a people and maintaining our culture.
And I understand the I'm gonna call it strategic vision and strategic intent as far as self autonomy. And I think I heard you say for out of this, is that every year the summit? And does that mean that there is this the Independence Day a platform towards the summit, or is the summit another organizing mechanism of leadership that will occur after the Independence Day event.
African Independence Day is a segue to the summit. Summit ultimately will be solution-oriented and solution-based to begin to implement the ideas of nationhood, of right. statehood. Right. We must move towards that answer before the end of the 21st century. If not, we're looking at our own extinction. We're looking at being wiped out as a people by the end of the 21st century.
And I can understand that and see it. I'm just trying to get clarity of whether those individual leaders, because it goes to my first question, but those individual leaders or that summit is something that is being formulated or it's right now in the planning stage of that type of leadership that will come together to consolidate those plans. Is that summit already planned or is it to be planned?
We're planning it as we speak.
Okay.
So yes, we're planning as we speak and we will have more on it. I'm looking to have the summit together by 2019.
Okay.
In 2 years. We've been discussing and throwing back and forth. I know some of the brothers are ready to do it next year. And if we even do it next year, it'll be on a smaller level. But by 2019, we should be ready and we should be prepared to have an African Independence International Summit here in Philadelphia by August of 2019.
And Ella, you know, it's just interesting. You know, I'm a docent at the African American Museum in Philadelphia. So one of the exhibits that we're is called Philaesthetics is celebrating the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s. And you know, in Philadelphia, one of the Black Power Conference was held in Philadelphia, which was one of those summits. And I'm bringing that up because I think it's important to make those historical connections. And they were a culmination of different leaderships from different ideological positions who were also saying that we should craft a position that becomes self-autonomous at that point. So to hear you're saying now that, you know, the out of African Independence Day, that's to occur again. I'm quite interested in the leadership or the coalition that will assemble, and also tied to Elliot's question, that the defense mechanisms are has more historical understanding to protect itself, so it could stay in formation and compared to disintegration because of outside forces.
Yeah, I would just say that you're absolutely right. And to do this on an international level, understanding that we need to come together with our African brothers and sisters who are continental-born African brothers and sisters from the continent, as well as our Caribbean brothers. We have to understand, we have to make Pan-Africanism real. You know what I mean? Not just an idea in theory, but an idea in practice of being able to align ourselves with our African brothers and sisters, not just at home or in the Caribbean, but throughout the diaspora, and make it an international struggle for liberation. I mean, this is what so many of our great leaders, from the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey to Brother Minister Malcolm X, visualized and thought about and wanted to bring into existence. And we have to continue that work until that idea is fulfilled. You know what I mean? And it comes into actual practice, but it has to be done. And it's our only solution to having what it is that we a need for our survival and our continued existence as African people in this world.
I would like, Elliot, I'll start with this, but I Brother Obi, I agree with you wholeheartedly. From, you know, the conception and the conceptualization and the theoretical perspective, from the operational operational perspective, what I would see is our challenge when I look at us locally, and I use that adage of think globally, act locally, because, I would see, especially as UNIA members, especially as Garveyites, to be able to bring those assemblage of, because say in West Philadelphia, where the African Independence Day is held, you have a large contingent of Africans living in that geographical space. You have a large contingent of Caribbean individuals living in that geographical space of West Philly, around specifically around Malcolm X Park, to be able to create that kind of tie, as you said. It would be, to operationalize that would be really, the model for other cities, whether that's in the South, the North, the Midwest, or the West, what we have to do in order to be able to, truly make this happen, which it did happen, as we know, in the history of the UNIA when they had the convention of 1922. They came from all over, but for right now, it would be just, it was nice for us to be able to make that happen in Philadelphia amongst those leadership and those different groups, so that we can be able to do that type of interrelating commerce, cultural activities, educational formation, and as you said, actually put young people through that rites of passage process in a unified manner.
Brother Oba and Brother Kamal,
hey. Yes.
Let me, because I guess we got about 20 more minutes. It might be a half hour left in the program, so we can talk a little bit, and if folks can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. You two brothers, let me throw this out, because I'd like your feedback on it. And Brother Ober, I want you to understand that I agree wholeheartedly with what you were saying earlier in reference to politics. But I see things going on now that can help us move forward in the future. And when I say that, I'm saying this because Mr. Garvey's whole movement was about our people being independent and sovereign again. And being independent and sovereign is meaning to me controlling your economy and governing yourself. You see movements going on now. Let's buy black365.com. Us lifting us. They started one locally here in Philadelphia. I buy black. All of these things are, if practiced, is helping us move towards a specific goal as a people. Now, other people that's involved might have other things in mind, but conscious individuals that get involved in efforts like that are trying to move our people towards a specific goal of sovereignty. Governing ourselves, to me, is a must. And I think that if we practice black power politics, black belt politics, and it's going on now in the South in different areas, we've had representation from the Universal African People's Party, the Black is Back Coalition, Brother Cam Howard, who is the legislative chair of NCOBRA, that they're holding the Black is Back convention, black political convention in Chicago in August. Richard mentioned the 1 million conscious and conscientious black voters and contributors. It's a lot of conscious individuals that are running conscious black folks as candidates for certain offices. And when I say certain offices, I'm not talking about national office where you get guys like a Cory Booker, a Barack Obama, and these other people. I'm not dealing with that. You get what you get when you see those folks. But I'm talking about local governments, neighborhood council people that control a certain amount of dollars in these communities, but none of the dollars get to the people that need it. You look at a lot of our communities, and I'll deal specifically with Philadelphia. Black politicians all over the place. And all you see is neighborhoods being gentrified. And the people hollering about it's no services, no. But it seems kind of odd that when a neighborhood gets gentrified, here comes the services. And all those old nasty old corner places like Asian restaurants, Dominican places all over, Latino places all over, when white folks take those areas, all those businesses hit the road too. They're not in those communities. Here come white businesses. Those communities seem to follow black people because we've been patronizing them. Well, those are politicians that control a certain amount of those dollars locally. If we ran conscious individuals and conscious candidates to run against those individuals as an independent, no party affiliation, that it will immediately cause an uproar in this city. You know, Martin Luther King made that statement, practical solutions that we can all do. That is a practical solution. I'll give an example. You're doing a lot of work in West Philadelphia, Brother Ober. And Richard just mentioned about the community around that area of Malcolm X Park. So a lot of our people that know what you're doing, know what's in your heart, know the passion you have for the community. Just say, for an example, one day, you or somebody that you know and trust that have the same values and mindset as you do, say, listen, run this man as a councilman in this area so we can control some of these dollars that we already paying taxes for. We pay taxes in these communities, just like white folks that take all the services. And just say, for example, you or Brother Kamal say, I'm running for this seat. And I'm going to get support from these people. And I'm not running as no Democrat or Republican. I'm running as a no party affiliation.
I mean, you know where I'm going.
But
And I want to add that.
Give me your opinion. I want both of your opinion on it.
We have been involved with the city to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
Making them aware. We have been invited to a monthly meeting along with Jamie Blackswell, Committee for Caribbean and African communities. Last week we went and it was a really great experience because we had the opportunity to meet with around 30 African young leaders, in which out of those 30, we had several of those brothers come fellowship with us. They came to our home. I actually spent time with one of the brothers today. But we have to absolutely utilize our local government to its maximal benefit. I think that that is our direct – the local government has a direct impact on – our community affairs,
mm-hmm.
and even organizing this event alone. We recently joined with Sister. I told you we had a meeting at in West Philly with a sister who's a real estate. She has a real estate company and a community center.
She was on a program.
Well, she was on your program?
Yeah, we interviewed her, Elliot, at the Black Locks Conference.
Oh, excellent.
Okay. All
so
right.
these are the connections and the alliances that, you know, we are working on. But I totally know where you're going with this. And you know, I would be remiss to say, you know, no. I mean, it takes a level of organization and coordination to put something like this on and to have a foresight on seeing where we're trying to go with this. So, yeah, things are definitely in motion and in the plans.
And I think I like to add, Elliot and Brother Eli, Brother Kamo, that it doesn't, I think, you know, from where you started, though, I think it's important. And I want to just add that from this perspective of, because those candidates or that, that I'm calling inside outside, I call the outside being engaged in electoral politics. I'm calling the inside being, say, if we use, say, the UNIA as the governing body that selects, because it has divisions, not just, you know, in different geographical areas, but around the world, but but because our people are in these political framework, that the internal decisions of how we're going to approach the external institutions or political machinery can still, I think, ideologically or idealistically still stay within the framework of sovereignty, because you can be an independent entity who is working in another environment, if that makes sense, in the sense that you making governmental decisions, bringing policies from your governmental perspective, but you're placing it in the electoral process of, in this case, it would be the county or the state of Pennsylvania, just for example. And that can happen in any place, but therefore it's still governed from within, not necessarily you're going in and then they're shaping you and telling us what we should be doing, if even doing is doing nothing, you know, just letting our people just languish when they're providing the resources. That's what
I would say it like this. I agree with what you're saying, brother. And I definitely agree with what Brother Kamu is saying. Brother Minister Malcolm taught us many, many years ago in his speech, Ballot or the Bullet. He said that for us as African people in this country to become, that he wanted for us to become more politically mature and understanding that we, if there was a candidate that was running for office that was out here who espoused upon the ideas and the various things that we needed as an African people in America to improve our conditions and in our community, and wasn't just about talk, but was really truly about the work of the restoration of our African communities within our inner cities and all over the country, then vote for that candidate, support that candidate. But if there's a candidate that is not talking that, that is not on the docket or not the platform in which that candidate is coming from, then easily we don't support that candidate with our vote. So we use our vote, as Baba Khalid Abdul Muhammad used to say, as a cock hammer, as a weapon. Right. We have such individuals, or in the case of Baba Chokwe Lumumba.
Yes.
You know, I would love to have 100 Baba Chokwe Lumumbas, you know. So I would support Baba Chokwe, candidates like Baba Chokwe Lumumba and the work that he had done. Unfortunately, you know, we lost him, and you know, but there are others. And
his son won that seat down there in Jackson. He was on the program, and he's definitely practicing.
I know.
Practicing.
And I actually listened to that program that he was on when you had him on, Brother Elliot.
Okay.
So I understand that, and I understand exactly where you're coming from.
Okay.
But I also want to answer this part of your question as well. With all of these various different movements, and it's great to see that there are a number of different movements, including here in Philadelphia with the I Buy Black.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Philadelphia, there is Let's Buy Black 365. There's a number of different movements going on locally and nationally throughout this country that is striving to and speaking to the conditions of African people and striving to improve them economically.
They're wonderful. They're great. But one of the things that I even raised today earlier at the UNIA, earlier today, and it's one of the things that we talked about, I think that you can't – it's very difficult to start movements without having African spiritual cosmology at the core of what it is that you're doing. We've started a lot of movements that are black movements that we want and saw as something that we needed as progressive movements to help to change our condition. And a lot of them that don't have a healthy respect, and this is one of the things we talked about today, earlier, for African spiritual cosmology at its center, a lot of those movements fell apart. African spiritual cosmology is something that is very similar to mortar, to brick. You can build a house with bricks, but if it has no mortar that connects the bricks together where you can build the foundation and the solid foundation, then that house is going to fall apart. So I compare African spiritual cosmology to mortar, and you have to have mortar. It is the glue in which each brick sits upon and is able to stay firm in its place. And a lot of these movements that are starting are great and wonderful, but I just was wondering how much respect do they have for African spiritual cosmology to be at the core of that movement. We have many movements that started, such as even such as the Black Panther Party, and we've talked about the Black Panther Party for self-defense. And there were a lot of things that that they did great, and then there were some things that we have to talk about and some things that they didn't do that was well. That weren't necessarily productive. I personally believe that one of the reasons why it fell apart was because of the fact that it didn't have understanding or have a disdain based on its lack of understanding of African spiritual cosmology. Because if it had it at its core, it probably still would exist. And this is some of the things that Baba Khaled Abdul Muhammad, who established or helped to establish the new Black Panther Party, understood. He has to understand. He understood the significance of our Africanity and us going back to certain things spiritually and that needed to be at the foundation of many of these movements that we're starting, that we want to help improve the conditions of African people here in America.
But doesn't when we speak from the perspective of self-governance, those movements, and hopefully they're just not movements, but organizational efforts, who are trying to provide material resources for their constituency. Shouldn't we have a mechanism where those organizations, representatives of who have that kind of foundation and who don't have that kind of foundation can sit at a table and actually negotiate how do we get more resources for the people that we represent? And that's the question about governance and self-governance and self-autonomy, isn't it? That we create a vehicle where our different organizations, one we would perceive is not developed and others we perceived are developed, can still sit at a table and negotiate how we're going to gain more resources for the people we represent. And that we don't have that right now.
Agreed. I agree with that. Yes, we should have that dialogue and that conversation. But we also have to keep this in mind. When we talk about self-governance, when we talk about autonomy, we're talking about doing it from an African-centered perspective. We're mm-hmm. talking about doing it the way that we do it as Africans, which is unique. Not to blackenize it and to just say, okay, well, we govern ourselves and that we are autonomous, but we're still doing things the way that the European does it. Mm-hmm. We're blackenizing it. And what I mean by that, and I just want to qualify it, what I mean by that is that if we ever, come into self-governance and autonomy and things of that nature, it's like going down to the White House and taking
some MAB paint and opening up the MAB paint that's black and putting and dipping a paintbrush into it and painting the black house white. Okay, you painted the black house white, but it's still you still are inundated with the mindset of running things and doing things the same way that white people did it. You know what I'm saying? Although that the white although the White House now is the black house. You know what I mean? Blackenizing is not the type of self-governance we need. Blackenizing things is not the type of autonomy we need. We need to come from a complete African paradigm in order to be able to sustain ourselves as an African people.
And I don't disagree with that. What I'm projecting is, and I'm asking for the feedback, but I just want to make sure we're clear, we're on the same page, because what I see in our historical sojourn, there is a community of Africans of African descent or African historical perspective, as you say, what we call them Afropeans, right? They believe in the American thing, but they're them and their constituency because they're black and because Western civilization or American empire doesn't respect them because they're black, they get less resources than if they were white ethnics, white Irish, white Germans, white Jews, they get less. And they know that. And then there's, as you said earlier, about the Maroon community who know we would like to create a self-autonomous community where our economy and our children and our children-to-be will be protected. But we know that every time we've created those formulations, that they have been systemically destroyed, either by being implants or by external force of power. And then there's those who may be in the middle of the road, but all three are striving individually or telling each other what they don't have compared to saying, well, we know we have the same common enemy, which is what Malcolm did say, right? And therefore, if we know we got the same common enemy, I'm not trying to convince you to be like me. I'm just trying to get you to be able to. Can we get together so we can get what we need so I can do what I got to do? And I'm saying that platform is what the governing mechanism that I don't see. Like the OA, which used to be the OAU, now is the African Union. They're 50 states, right? Artificially developed. But let's not even deal with that because they're modern. Let's deal with West Africa before colonialism, pre-colonial Africa. Didn't they have coalitions of ethnic nations who had different spiritualities, different social systems, but they were able to come together and create a confederation or coalition because they had common, they were able to trade with each other. Therefore, they were able to create relationships with each other that would help both sides benefit. Isn't that dealing with Africanity in its purest, even if it's idealistic?
If you ask me that question, there were entities that did exist like that. We have to be careful and keep in mind that coalitions are something that are not permanent. Coalitions are things that are in many senses temporary. Once a goal is achieved, usually coalitions don't last after the goal has been reached. So then it has to become something else. And other than a coalition, it has to become a new entity and a new body and defined a little bit differently once the goal has been met or the objective has been met. So we have to be very, very careful in understanding that, how that whole thing looks with being able to sit down and talk at the table with individuals of different religious ideologies and spiritual ideologies and things of that nature. you know, that's a very delicate thing, man. And a lot of people are going to, you know, impose ideas that everybody at that particular table, you know, does not necessarily agree with. That is for the that they claim is in the best interest of African people. That's a very, very difficult thing. We've not reached that particular point yet, but I'm almost assured sitting here tonight that we will reach that particular point, and that's going to be something that's going to be a challenge for us. I may be saying it because I'm being biased, because I, you know, myself was born and raised in African spiritual system that I, you know, practice today. So, of course, for me, I'm coming from an area that is very, very, very personal for me. Everybody doesn't necessarily share the same views that I have. You know, most of us who practice African spiritual cosmology from the various different systems understand the likenesses and things that we have in common, because if you look throughout the diaspora of Africa, if you look throughout the continent, there are various different systems, there's various different names for different things, but the principles and ideas are very much the same. But outside of that, you know, you have brothers and sisters that are into things that, you know, are not, you know, practiced from an African base. And so that's where you run into difficulty, whether it may be Christianity, Islam, or, you know, Judaism, or whatever, you know, so forth and so on. So, but that's something that we have to understand is going to be real. And we got to be able to deal with that when that time comes. And that time will come for us. Will we live to see it? I don't know. Willfully, we will. But it's got to. But we have to be able to have that type of conversation and be clear on the importance and the significance of African spiritual cosmology and how it plays a role in the new world that we as African people want to create.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll wind things down, and Brother Oba, Brother Kamal, the floor will be yours to kind of highlight the African Independence Day celebration, which will be held in Philadelphia here August 5th at Malcolm X Park at 52nd and Pine Street. We'll be right back.
Are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
antiquity to the present. Our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. Sundays, 7 p.m. with your host,
Reggie. Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here. As many of you know, last March, when it was announced that I was no longer in the Black Muslim movement, it was pointed out that it was my intention to work among the 22 million non-Muslim Afro-Americans and to try and form some type of organization or create a situation where the young people, our young people, the students and others, could study the problems of our people for a period of time and then come up with a new analysis and give us some new ideas and some new suggestions as to how to approach a problem that too many other people had been playing around with for too long. And that we would have some kind of meeting and determine at a later date whether to form a black nationalist party or a black nationalist army. There have been many of our people across the country from all walks of life who have taken it upon themselves to try and pool their ideas and to come up with some kind of solution to the problem that confronts all of our people. And tonight we are here to try and get an understanding of what it is they've come up with.
The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never find, you can't open up a black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you who don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community. But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community. Control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses, under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The economic philosophy of black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer, the community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man. The man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar out.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're joined in conversation this evening with Brother Oba Olainka and Brother Kamal, organizers of the African Independence Day celebration in Philadelphia at 52nd and Pine Street at Malcolm X Park. Will be held on August 5th. And before we wind up the conversation this evening, it's been interesting dialogue with both brothers. Brother Oba, Brother Kamal, the floor is yours. You can recap what's going to be going on, some of the folks that they'll hear, and some of the folks that they'll not only enjoy the entertainment, but some of the folks that they'll hear.
Once again, the 13th Annual African Independence Day Mind Celebration will take place Saturday, August the 5th, from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Malcolm X Memorial Park, 52nd and Pine Streets in the West Philadelphia section of the city. We will be the theme this year will be Pan-Africanism or Perish. We will be featuring United Front, Oshun, Dr. James Small, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr., Denise Valentine, Universal African Dance and Drum Ensemble, Mama Pam Africa, Brother Ajay Tembe, UNIACL President Michael R. Duncan, Ifatunde Fayemi, Richard Raw, Tahir RBG, The Urban Shamans, Kamara Arts, Jazara, and the Moonshadow Band, a Children's Pavilion, Health Pavilion, and Education Pavilion, as well as an African Marketplace. And we will have our first annual Ahmed Akil Tahir Pearl of Africa Award presentation, as well as the Marcus Garvey Do For Self Junkanoo Parade, which will take place before African Independence Day from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., starting at 52nd Art Street in West Philadelphia, and it will process and end at Malcolm X Memorial Park, 52nd and Pine Street, the site of the 13th Annual African Independence Day Mosque Celebration. For more information, you can go to africanindependenceday@gmail.com, or you can go to africanindependenceday.org. That is our webpage. You can also give us a call at 267-521-1544. Once again, you can give us a call at 267-521-1544. We spell African, A-F-R-A-K-A-N. Once again, that's A-F-R-A-K-A-N, African Independence Day. And you can also give a call if you're interested in vending at 267-978-1256. If you're interested in vending at this year's African Independence Day Mosque Celebration, the number to call is 267-978-1256. Good.
Brother Kamau, any last?
I'm just excited. Individuals okay. Want to volunteer. They want to volunteer. Again, of course, you can go to our website. We have applications. We have the contact information. There's still room for participants. So please just reach out.
And also, too, I just want to say that I know you will be doing a simulcast live that Saturday at African Independence Day, at the 13th Annual African Independence Day Mosque Celebration. So we look forward to having you, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, to be with us this year at African Independence Day. We are so much looking forward to you all being a part of this year's celebration.
Thank you, sir. I'll probably meet with you. I don't know when you're going to be down that way, but we'll get together because I just want to go over there and see how things are set up and where you want us to be and things of that nature.
Oh, sure. No problem. And we will talk this week and we will make that happen. We'll go out to the park and it should be no problem. Okay. The park has Wi-Fi, so I'm looking forward to that. Yes, sir.
Listen, we got, hold on a second. 267 area code. 267? I guess they must have stepped away from the phone. Listen, I want to thank you, brothers, for being with us. We'll be looking forward to meeting you, seeing you out there, seeing the event. And Brother Richard, any last words before?
I really appreciate the exchange, and I go along with Brother Malcolm in relationship to listening and engaging with the new ideas to see what we were going to come up with. So it's and a part being a part of that African Independence Day is a part of that process, and I'm definitely enjoy it, and hopefully we'll learn from it.
Brothers, I'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you.
Brother Richard, interesting conversation we had with both guests tonight.
Yes. It's the topics. Both topics are ones that's going to obviously generate, as they say, a lot of buzz for now and in the future.
Yeah, it's a. It was an interesting conversation. I'm looking forward to attending the event out there, seeing a number of people engaging, some of the young people especially, you know, about their feelings about being out there and what's going on.
Yes.
And that I think that's going to be interesting dialogue in itself. And also looking forward to Brother Rill's documentary coming out. That teaser that he has online is really, and I know you saw it,
Yes.
It gives you an indication of how Brother Rell is thinking about when he's putting together this documentary. Good brother. And I know that he's going to put a lot of his understanding in the documentary, and plus let the men speak for themselves that's been affected by these things. So it's going to be an interesting documentary when it comes out. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through